The United Nations is making secret contingency plans for a war that would halt all Iraqi production.
The anti-war movement today does not have a voice in the public debate equal to our numbers.
Let me be blunt. I don't trust what the administration is telling us about Iraq.
Because the no-fly zones have not been imposed by the United Nations, they do not take that as a breach of the UN requirements.
The Gulf War was notably the most toxic war we've ever fought, and will be again this time.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, December 23rd, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In his final press conference of the year, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announced today at the Pentagon that the U.S. is continuing to actively train Iraqi opposition forces for what he described as a post-Saddam Iraq. He also announced that the Department of Defense is mobilizing National Guard and Reserve troops in the event of war and refused to commit the United States to allowing U.N. inspectors to leave the country before the start of an attack on Iraq.
The UN passed a unanimous resolution giving Iraq an opportunity to comply with its disarmament obligations. The moment Saddam and his ruling clique seem to feel that they're out of danger, they will undoubtedly see no incentive to comply with their international obligations. We've continued working with the Iraqi opposition. We've taken steps to prepare for a post-Saddam transition, and we're continuing to work with friends and allies to keep the military pressure on Iraq. None of these steps reflect a decision by the President or the United Nations or anyone else, to my knowledge, to use force. The President has not made such a decision. In the period ahead, we'll continue to work with the United Nations member states to encourage Iraqi compliance. As the President said, the use of force is the last choice. The goal is for Iraq to comply with UN resolutions. Think about it. A decision was made a number of years ago for the United States military to put in the reserves and the guard as opposed to the active forces. So we're doing that. So it's a process that's going to be going forward as we move ahead.
Commitment to let the inspectors get out before any hypothetical military action would begin.
We don't have commitments to do anything.
War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld speaking with reporters at the Pentagon. While the U.S. pushes for answers from Iraq over what it perceives as omissions or gaps in the Iraqi report submitted to the U.N. Security Council, others are equally concerned about conspicuous omissions in the document after it left U.S. hands. It was a much abbreviated report with 8,000 pages deleted before it was handed over to the 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council. Many of those countries on the short end of the stick are furious over the treatment. Syria stormed out of the UN session last week, and Norway says it's been treated like a second-class country. Secretary General Kofi Annan admitted it was, in his words, unfortunate that the U.S. was allowed to have the only complete dossier for editing. So has the process been irreparably tainted by the U.S.? Phyllis Bennis, a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, says in addition to embarrassing information about U.S. and German firms supplying Iraq with materials to develop weapons of mass destruction, there was evidence of deeper U.S. involvement in nuclear weapons building.
Besides the corporate involvement, there was actually governmental involvement through the Department of Energy, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Commerce, and the nuclear labs, the Los Alamos Lab, the Sandia Lab, and the Lawrence Livermore Lab in California. All were involved in assisting Iraq's nuclear weapons programs. That was primarily in training, providing various kinds of non-fissile parts for the nuclear weapons, that sort of thing.
So what do we know new about the other pages that the U.S., these 8,000 pages that the U.S. tore? Was all that information contained in those 8,000 pages that the U.S. tore from the Iraq dossier?
Well, first of all, let me just make one clarification, Verna. The pages were removed not only by the U.S. alone. The U.S. had those pages for 24 hours alone and turned over theoretically an unedited version to the other four permanent members. The UN arms inspectors themselves also had an unedited version. The edited version was put together through a combination of the edits and cuts made by the U.S. and the arms inspectors as well as perhaps the other four members. So it wasn't solely the U.S. that was involved in that process.
So it's inaccurate to say that the U.S. tore 8,000 pages
from
the Iraq
dossier. That's right. What was removed from that dossier by that process, which was, in my view, certainly hijacked by the United States to the detriment of the other members of the council, what was included in that is the information about corporate and governmental involvement with Iraq's weapons programs, as well as how-to information, as well as a number of pages of unknown information in Arabic. There may be other things as well that we simply don't know yet what is in that material.
But the bottom line, in your opinion, Phyllis, is that for the U.S. to be rushing to judgment about any material breach is far too premature at this point.
Absolutely premature. It's also, Verna, as your listeners will remember, it's in violation of what the new UN resolution, 1441, actually says. 1441 says very explicitly that material breach requires two sets of conditions. One has to do with omissions or lies within the declaration, and that may or may not exist, as we know that that's still too premature to say. But it also requires lack of cooperation with the inspectors on the ground. And that's exactly the opposite of what we're hearing.
Well, is the U.S. not demanding that Iraq provide scientists to leave the country to be interviewed? Could that not be perceived as Iraq failing to cooperate with the inspectors on the ground?
Well, I think we can certainly anticipate that that's one of the things the U.S. is using to claim lack of cooperation. The problem is it doesn't exist yet. The Iraqis have been presented with a letter from Hans Blix asking for the names of scientists that are involved in these programs. And the Iraqis have said they are putting that together, and they will provide the list at the end of the month as Blix asked them. So there is no non-compliance yet. They've said that they're still considering the question of what they will do if asked to allow some scientists to leave the country. But Blix and his team have not yet asked for that. So there is no non-compliance on the Iraqi side.
A bit more about these scientists. Once Iraq, or once President Saddam Hussein and his administration provide this list of names, will these scientists have any say-so in whether or not they want to leave the country to be interviewed?
Well, it remains very unclear. That's one of the big problems that Hans Blix has raised with the whole procedure, saying, you know, what about those who don't want to leave? We are not going to force somebody against their will to leave their country. The U.S. has not responded to that question of what happens if scientists themselves don't want to leave. Now, certainly it may be that some scientists do want to leave. Some will want to get asylum. After all, Iraq has been going through 12 years of war and sanctions and is on the verge of facing a potentially catastrophic war. It's certainly likely that many scientists, like many other Iraqis, would jump at the chance to get asylum in a safe country. Whether that is, in fact, how it plays out, we don't know. The U.S. has already said that they are not prepared to automatically offer asylum to every scientist. What will be the conditions on which they will decide remains uncertain. So there's just enormous unknown parts to that whole issue.
And we're hearing today reports that the Iraqis shot down an unmanned U.S. military plane.
I think that it is quite likely the U.S. has been significantly escalating the pace and the numbers and frequency of flights in the so-called no-fly zones, both of regular planes and of these unpiloted drone planes. So if the Iraqi capacity to shoot down U.S. planes using their radar has clearly not been very strong. They've been trying for years and have not managed to shoot down a U.S. plane. Whether that somebody got lucky is certainly possible. The U.S., if they continue to send these unmanned drones into Iraqi territory, presumably the effort to protect Iraqi airspace will continue, and at some point somebody in Iraq may get lucky. The problem the U.S. faces, of course, with these so-called no-fly zones is that they are not authorized by the United Nations. So the U.S. and British patrols of these no-fly zones are not considered legal by UN authority.
But might not the U.S. decide that that's a provocation and therefore material breach and use this to trigger somehow launching an attack?
That is certainly the danger. The U.S. has been saying for quite some time that it views the firing on ships, on planes, and the painting of radar on planes, locking on radar, that sort of thing, as inherently a breach. But other members of the Council have been very clear that they do not view that as a breach of the UN resolutions, that the because the no-fly zones have not been determined by the United Nations or not imposed by the United Nations, they do not take that as a breach of the UN requirements. This is something between the U.S. and Iraq.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. Peace Watch has since learned that officials with the UN Nuclear Agency have begun interviewing Iraqi nuclear scientists on a one-on-one basis, but a chief spokesman says they're not revealing when or how many or with whom. Ralph and Maya Schoen, commentators with Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, raise questions about serious omissions on the part of the U.S.
On December 19th, Secretary of State Colin Powell stated in a press conference that the 12,200-page report from Iraq was recycled information and flagrant omissions. In fact, quote, there are material omissions that, in our view, constitute another material breach. What Secretary of State Colin Powell didn't tell us about are the real material omissions on the part of the United States and UN in complicity with it. The United Nations is making secret contingency plans for a war that would halt all Iraqi production, seriously degrade the country's electricity system, provoke civil unrest, and create 900,000 refugees. In the Gulf War, there were over 1 million Kurdish refugees alone. And this war, although the United Nations states 900,000 refugees, their actual estimation is even greater.
Actually, in the Daily Mirror's article in London on the 22nd, they disclosed that there has been a continuous war in Iraq. 36,000 sorties, 24,000 combat missions in the last 18 months alone, destroying civilian infrastructure across Iraq with absolute mute response from the United Nations. And that illuminates the piece in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 20th about the plans for the UN to oversee the future of Iraqi oil after the destruction of this war in Iraq, with Wolfowitz and the U.S. Hawks providing for actual control over the oil fields, while Colin Powell and the Pentagon's military leadership will assign the UN oversight to give that fig leaf of UN legitimacy to the seizure of oil on the ground. That's the real meaning of all of this operation, this facade of UN inspections, and with Blix declaring that the dossier reveals nothing, it's preparation for the war and the seizure of the oil with UN sanction. Nothing more, nothing less.
These are the real material omissions. This is Maya Schoen.
And Ralph Schoenman.
Peace Watch has learned the Turkish army has plans to invade and occupy a large part of northern Iraq as part of a possible U.S. war to oust Saddam Hussein. From the Turkish capital of Ankara, Aaron Glantz takes a look at the Turkish military's plan and its possible implications.
Dr. Arjun Gunin flips through the pages of the large Iraq binder that sits on the desk of his spacious office in central Ankara, the Turkish capital. The president of the Turkish Red Crescent has been meeting regularly with Turkish and international officials, planning relief efforts for possible war on Iraq. Gunin says International Red Cross Red Crescent plans to set up relief camps inside Iraqi territory after the Turkish army invades. Gunin points at a shaded area on his map. He says it represents a Turkish-occupied buffer zone. The occupied area would include the Iraqi cities of Duhok and Erbil and come up to the outskirts of the Kurdish-controlled city of Mosul, which holds billions of dollars in oil reserves.
Duhok.
A circular by former Prime Minister Bülent Ecevit released in October called for 13 Turkish-run relief camps in northern Iraq, staffed by Turkish military, the Turkish intelligence agency, and the Red Crescent. The plan calls for the camps to be surrounded by barbed wire. The Red Crescent's Dr. Günen says this plan is better than allowing the refugees to flee to safety in Turkey.
We will have the chance to save time in providing services. We have to register people, and when they decide to go back, we have to do several procedures. In this way, we won't have to do this. They will be in their own countries because of the security reasons. And when we look at this buffering zone on the map, we see there is infrastructure. So in case of the bigger need, it will be easier for us to provide support.
Turkey's army is the third largest in the world, with more than 15,000 troops already massed on the border. Newspaper reports here say the Turkish army plans to increase its force at the border to 60,000 within a month. In August, Turkey's defense minister called the Iraqi cities of Mosul and Kirkuk historic Turkish lands and said they would be best served by coming under what he called Ankara's direct safekeeping. The cities of Mosul and Kirkuk were part of the Ottoman Empire until 1918, when Britain seized the land from Turkey and gave it to a friendly Iraqi monarch. Unexplored oil reserves within Mosul and Kirkuk are worth an estimated $10 billion. Sanad Emedha is president of the Iraqi Turkmen Front. He took part in talks in London this week, where opposition groups designed a government for a post-Saddam Iraq.
We want Turkey to protect our national identity in Iraq. We want Turkey to support us. We just want protection. It might be economic protection, it might be political protection. We just need protection.
The possibility of a Turkish occupation of northern Iraq makes human rights activists here in Turkey uneasy. Karzis Biggi is with the Human Rights Association in Istanbul. In the last 20 years, the Turkish military has killed more than 30,000 Kurds.
We are afraid that if the army goes to northern Iraq while doing this operation, they can commit a new genocide against the Kurdish people. They can do this. We are afraid of this. The U.S. is telling our country that no Kurdish men will be in this war on our side, so we are very afraid.
Farai Salman is general secretary of the same organization. She's especially worried about possible human rights abuses inside the camps overseen by the Turkish army, especially since the Turkish state has yet to indicate it will allow human rights groups inside to inspect the camps.
I mean, this is the war, and we know that, you know, Turkey has got concerns about the reformulation of the northern Iraq or the Iraq itself. Turkey seems that undisturbed, quite disturbed about the, this Kurdish state, establishment Kurdish state. Then, therefore, we don't know how they will be treating people in the camps, who are going to come to the camps, what they are going to do to people in the northern Iraq, you know, to be sure, you know, what the Turkish state wants in the area. I mean, this is the main thing, actually, difficulty.
Ahmet İçdoğru is founder of the Association for Solidarity with Asylum Seekers and Migrants. He says the best way to support refugees is to promote peace in the region. Like 80% of the Turkish people, he opposes war on Iraq.
Starting from Afghanistan, Iran, even Pakistan, then the Iraq and Turkey, what we are witnessing that this is the kind of zone of wars, continuing the wars. And in fact, when we look at the whole asylum-seeking problem around the world, last 10 years, these are the major source countries, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and including Turkey partly. These are the main source countries of the asylum seekers around the world. I'm not talking about only Turkey, but I'm talking about United States, Canada, including Australia. These are the main source countries. So if a kind of Western world wants a kind of solution to the whole problem, maybe they should think that the solution is a kind of solution should come into the region. Yes, yeah. I mean, if you don't want to this type of this many refugees around the world, somehow you should think that this region's problem should be solved, okay, and peacefully solved.
But in Ankara today, Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced he is sending Prime Minister Abdullah Gül to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria to try to convince those governments to join Turkey in George Bush's coalition for war on Iraq. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Ankara.
As the U.S. government prepares to send tens of thousands of troops into war in a possible war in Iraq, the fight continues for justice and fair compensation for the veterans suffering from their service in the last Gulf War. In the first of two reports, Peace Watch correspondent Melinda Tuhus examines the price of Gulf War vets are paying and what the future holds.
More than a third of the over 500,000 veterans who served in the Gulf War a decade ago have successfully filed claims for disabilities attributed to that conflict. That compares to only 10% of vets granted disability benefits in both World War II and the Vietnam War, according to Steve Robinson, who heads the National Gulf War Resource Center. But in many cases, even when the claim is acknowledged as service-connected, vets don't receive monetary compensation. Robinson says it should be no surprise that so many Gulf vets got sick.
Gulf War illness. Think of it as a pie, and within that pie there are sections of that pie that affected certain people, but not all people. So Gulf War illnesses, one section that affected people was depleted uranium. One section that affected people was the vaccines that they took. Another section was those that had exposures to chemical and biological warfare agents. Another section was respiratory illnesses that people got from being around oil well fire and oil well fire smoke. Now, that all makes perfectly good sense to me and you, but the Department of Defense doesn't necessarily want to buy into that analogy. They want you to prove it. The Gulf War was notably the most toxic war we've ever fought, and will be again this time. The exposures that occurred there were remarkable, even by the admission of the Department of Defense. You had the smallest sand in the world that is respirable, approximately 2 microns. You had the largest environmental disaster known to man at that time in the burning of the 600 oil well fires. You had the use of depleted uranium, which was used all over the entire battlefield. So all of these things, and then you had over 982 facilities that we bombed during the pre-war phase. We bombed known chemical weapons storage facilities, and then other places that we didn't know what was there. And then we had 100 places that we did demolition operations on. So it was and continues to be, and is to this day, a very toxic place.
For years, the Pentagon and the Department of Veterans Affairs insisted that Gulf War veterans' health complaints were caused by stress. That diagnosis made them ineligible for disability benefits. The burden of proof that a certain exposure caused a specific illness was almost impossible to meet, Robinson points out.
These injuries are just as real as a landmine going off underneath your feet, but the problem is that doctors can't see them, and you have to do very expensive magnetic resonance spectroscopy to look at the deep brain structures to see the lesions and the damage that are done by these types of toxic exposures. And when you do them, you absolutely see them, and it's just as damaging as stepping on a mine. But for the last 11 years, science wasn't understanding that the toxic exposures of the Gulf War were the causal factors in why veterans were sick.
But with exposure to such a toxic environment, why did the government ignore it?
The reason is because they can. If we allow the Department of Defense to be the sole repository for information when it comes to exposures or illnesses that veterans face, and there's no mechanism by which you can reach into that lockbox and get the information out, then you're forced to wait. Gulf War veterans have been waiting 11 years. Vietnam veterans waited 30 years. Atomic veterans waited 50 years.
It wasn't just those who served during actual combat almost 12 years ago who got sick, according to Major Doug Rocky, a 35-year combat veteran and an Army health physicist.
Since 1991, an additional 60,000 individuals that have served in that region have now been awarded VA disability. 60,000. They weren't there during combat. They went in afterwards, which means that the contamination that's present or the immunizations, that anthrax vaccine that's disastrous, is making them sick, and another 2,000 have died.
The science has started to catch up with the veteran symptoms, which is why so many Gulf veterans have now had their claims acknowledged. Several recent reports point to neurological roots for many of their ailments: joint pain, headaches, memory loss, rashes, balance problems, and loss of motor skills. These studies, including a report by the Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illnesses, led the VA to announce in October that it will spend $20 million in the next year on research into Gulf War illnesses. That's double any previous yearly allocation. Robinson, a 20-year combat veteran, served in the Gulf War and is a member of the advisory committee. Despite the progress, he points out that the VA has denied the disability claims of 78,000 Gulf War vets and that another 54,000 claims are pending. And the Bush administration recently announced it was withholding $275 million earmarked for medical treatment for vets.
The VA has started to consolidate and close down the clinics. And now veterans have to drive farther and farther, sometimes 6 hours, from wherever they live to go get treatment. It's going to cause people to not have access to care. Right. Care that they were promised when they raised their right hand and swore to defend the Constitution.
And what about the upcoming war? Will American military personnel be any better prepared this time? A report by Congress's General Accounting Office found that some improvements have been made. A 1998 law requires that military personnel receive medical exams, including mental health screening, before and after service in a combat zone, and mandates improved record keeping. The law should help soldiers establish health claims in case of illness after their return, but Robinson discovered it's rarely implemented. Of even greater concern is an Army report released through the Freedom of Information Act that documents that almost two-thirds of the Army's gas masks are defective, along with 90% of the detectors it uses to alert troops of invisible chemical attacks. No one from the Deployment Health Support Directorate, the Pentagon department that oversees the health of U.S. troops, would comment on the record about these issues. On background, a spokesperson said that efforts are ongoing to improve performance. Robinson said his group gets calls every day from worried military men and women. He says he can't allay their fears about defective equipment, but he does have some advice.
We tell soldiers, keep good medical records. Make sure you know what shots you're getting. Keep track of where you are during the conflict. Ask your company commander, hey, are we monitoring the environment?
Vets groups are also supporting veterans' right to know bills in both houses of Congress. They would require the Pentagon to fully disclose any exposure of military personnel to toxic hazards. Passage would open the lockbox in which the Pentagon currently keeps this information. This is Melinda Tuhus reporting.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, it's off to Baltimore for a rally. We'll stop by Southern California for a Tom Hayden speech, and we'll have a taste of the Breakfast of Champions exhibit opening next month in Brooklyn. We'll be back in a moment.